This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our program today was entitled Fixing Illinois School Funding Formula, and it was sort of a Noah's Ark kind of program. We had two Illinois senators and two Illinois reps, two Republicans and two Democrats dealing with a problem that is at least two decades old, and that is the educational system. How do we adequately fund and equitably support that system? There was general agreement among all parties that we have to come up with a program. The difference is, how do we address the issues raised by equity and adequate funding? All felt it was a crucial time for funding in the state of Illinois. The majority of the program revolved around Senate Bill 1, which will come before the Illinois House this week. Hopefully, some people hope that they override Governor Rauner's veto of this program. Others believe, including a couple of our panelists, as you will hear, that there is still more legislation and more attention that must be directed to adequate funding and equity. There are 852 school districts in the state of Illinois. Some have already started. Some will start in the coming days, and probably within about 10 days to 2 weeks, everybody, hopefully, will be back in school. So school is starting, but the big question remains, where and how will the money come from for these 852 districts? Our speakers today included Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from Macoupin County, a member of the Illinois Senate, Jason Berrickman, Republican state senator from Bloomington, Illinois, State Representative Will Davis, a Democrat from East Hazelcrest, Illinois, and retiring member of the Illinois House, Robert Pritchard, who represents the DeKalb area.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for having me on this really impeccably timed conversation. Wow. It could have been disaster, but instead we are, of course, right at a very crucial moment for education funding in the state of Illinois, obviously on Sunday, because I don't know. The General Assembly cannot stop itself from ruining everybody's weekends. Took a vote on what has really been come to be known as Senate Bill 1 in a way that I think not a lot of legislation actually, you never know the bill number. And when it comes to this education funding formula, Senate Bill 1 definitely has gone against that. And so the Senate, of course, as I'm sure you all well know, went ahead and overrode Governor Bruce Rauner's fairly sweeping veto of legislation that passed with mostly Democratic votes only in the spring, and then, of course, was held on to for a couple of months, which is partially why we are here at this moment as school. I think some districts begin in just a matter of days, even I think one tomorrow for Elgin, if I'm correct. Heading underway, not knowing when they will get their general state aid payments from Illinois government. It is under that umbrella that I will leave it to our panelists to discuss. And because I am a woman who likes organization and in honor of school teachers who taught me my ABCs at a wee age, let's go in alphabetical order here, beginning with Senator Jason Berrickman.
Thank you, Amanda, and to the City Club as well for hosting this great event. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to see many of our legislative colleagues in the audience, and of course to serve on this panel with three other individuals who, like myself, have spent years of their lives on this issue. And I have the utmost respect for each of the three here. You know, as I think we often joke, if it were as simple as getting four people to come to an agreement, this issue would be solved long ago. We live in a democracy, and certainly on this issue, this has been a very challenging one for us to solve. I thought that it would be important for me to outline briefly some of the brief kind of historical moments of this school funding debate, and then hone in on some of the facts that I think are important to frame for today's discussion. So for many years, many of us have been critical of the way in which the state of Illinois distributes its money. I often joke that I'm here today on this panel because some 4 or 5 years ago, I raised my hand in caucus and said, hey, I'd be willing to help try to solve this issue. Now, over the years, there's been rhetoric on both sides. You heard maybe a year or two ago the voices that said this is about parity, that we need parity in the way in which we fund our schools. And, of course, then some defined parity to mean the fact that CPS needed to have its pensions paid. You heard Republicans talk about the fact that CPS has some benefits under the law today that are not extended to other school districts. But there's this discussion about parity. We spent the spring on the Governor's Reform Commission. I was proud to be a member of that, as were my colleagues here. That commission produced a very good blueprint, a work product that the legislature could work from. It's important to recognize that that work product included agreements that the commissioners made, like the fact that we were not going to address pensions within the school funding formula, that as Republicans, we have said we would like to have input and a debate from Democrats on pension reform, but we all agreed for the commission rewriting the school funding formula, pensions was a side issue that ought best be dealt with outside that commission. We agreed to that. We also agreed to other things like the fact that we'd use an evidence-based funding model and that we'd utilize what's called a hold harmless on a per pupil, not a per district level. Now, in the spring, we engaged in negotiations over the actual legislation. Senate Bill 1 was a product of that. And, in fact, Republicans and Democrats were meeting regularly to negotiate the language included in SB 1. Late in May, specifically May 29th, at the end of the legislative cycle, amendments were added to SB 1 that did things that really changed the discussion. And as Republicans, we felt represented Democrats moving away from the negotiations and more in line with their priorities. That included amendments to Senate Bill 1 to allow for the state to pay Chicago's pension costs, health care costs, legacy pension costs. A number of issues that were not part of our negotiations suddenly became included in the legislation. Of course, the Democrats passed Senate Bill 1 on generally a Democrat vote and then held it for months, creating this unnecessary crisis around our state. More recently, the governor utilized his amendatory veto, like many others in the room. I read that for the first time when it was issued. And within that amendatory veto are some important policy issues that I think we negotiators and legislators will consider. But here's the thing that I think we need to focus on for today's discussion, which is not the rhetoric of what it is we're trying to do and why. I think we all believe we need to have a formula that's fixed, that's fair, that works for all 852 of our school districts, that removes the inequities that exist within the broken school funding formula today. But the facts that legislators are tussling with are these. Today, the state of Illinois does not pay Chicago's pension costs. I know that there are some people in the state who believe that the state should pay those costs. As a fact, the state does not today. The cost of those, the normal pension cost today, $165 million. I don't think there's a dispute over that. Senate Bill 1 proposes to change the existing law so that the state pays this normal pension cost. It also proposes that the state pay CPS's health care costs by embedding the value of that in the formula, and its legacy costs by adjusting the formula to offset those legacy costs. All facts. Today, Chicago has a block grant. A block grant is essentially a set-aside or a subsidy. It's valued at $250 million. The law today says that Chicago gets this benefit. Senate Bill 1 says we're going to take that benefit and we're going to put it right in the formula. We're not going to get rid of it. We're going to keep it. Also today, under the law, Chicago gets the ability to control some of its personnel costs through the law that favors Chicago. That same law does not benefit 851 other school districts. As part of our negotiations, Republicans and myself have said, why don't we extend the benefits given to Chicago? We don't want to take that away. We want to extend the benefits that Chicago has to control its costs to other school districts. We get a resounding no from Democrats on this issue. They want to change the law to pay Chicago's pensions. They want to retain the $250 million block grant, but they're unwilling to change the law to extend benefits that Chicago has to every other school district. And so I'll conclude. I'll conclude here. I heard the
sigh.
We want to fix the formula. It's imperative that we fix the formula. But what has been drawn, the line that's been drawn in the sand by Democrats, I believe, is one that's impossible for us to solve. They have said, as part of fixing school funding, we all agree it needs to be an evidence-based model, but they have said the state must pay Chicago's pensions. Now, some said, pull that out, we could get an agreement. Democrats have said it's a must-have. You got to pay the pensions in order to fix the formula. So Republicans have said, okay, let's negotiate it. What are you willing to trade in order to negotiate that? Will you extend the rights that Chicago has to control its costs to other school districts? The answer is no. This creates an impossible situation that must be overcome if we're to resolve this matter in the way that it should, a bipartisan agreement, and in the time that it should, which is now. So with that, thank you.
And I do think I a bit buried the lead here. Part of why this is such a wonderful panel for this point in time is because these are four of the eight negotiators that have been designated to negotiate by their leadership some sort of education compromise. There are also, of course, a call from the governor yesterday for legislative leaders to do the same. But really, these are half of the pros that are going to be making these decisions and parsing out all of the details. So without further ado, the next of those individuals, Representative Will Davis, the sponsor in the Illinois House of Senate Bill 1.
Thank you very much, Amanda. Good afternoon, everyone. Indeed, an honor and a pleasure to be here with you today. As I listen to my colleague, and I don't know how much sparring you want us to do up here.
Lots.
He talked about the history. Okay, well, let's start there. The history is that Illinois is last. That's the history, is that we have the most disparate system between state and local funding. Anybody concerned about their property taxes? Okay. Part of the reason your property taxes are where they are is because the state has abdicated its responsibility in terms of paying schools, in terms of paying what its fair share of school funding. If I can relatively quote my leader, Camille Lilly, who is the House Chair of the Black Caucus, she has consistently said that before we do anything else, we should put education first. That's primarily, the first thing is that we should put education first. So relative to some of the things that the senator said, as he talked about the recalcitrant of Democrats, I think Andy and I can probably talk about the recalcitrant of Republicans in this as well. Some things that they have brought into the negotiation that weren't a part of SB 1 that they've brought into the conversation and are expecting some kind of compromise on in order to try to get it done, particularly as we have worked into the formula provisions for the city of Chicago, as well as supporting all of the school districts. No school district loses under SB 1. Every school district gains. Now, the governor has indicated that districts gain more based on the changes that he's made. Well, sure, if you take money away from one school district and give it to everybody else, guess what? Everybody wins. Everybody gets more money. But it's happening at the expense of one other school district. And I don't want to not talk about that school district. It's the largest school district in the state. It educates the most number of low-income children, the most number of special education children, the most number of bilingual children. We cannot not deal with the city of Chicago in this conversation. So to the extent in which we attempt to do that, we didn't do it at the expense of any other district. Whereas the amendatory veto, which I assume we'll talk about, does do things at the expense of every other district. And it's important to recognize that. The senator talked about the governor's commission that I was a part of and how we walked through several things. And again, if you want to be fair, yes, we did do other things that weren't a part of the blueprint. But we did a lot of other things that weren't a part of the blueprint as well. But the blueprint is not concrete. As we walked forward after the governor's commission, we realized that there was a need to do other things. And SB 1 is the reflection of all the other things that we felt that we needed to do to try to make schools better. The evidence-based model, everybody, some people agree, some people have criticized it, but it's a different way of doing things. And unfortunately, in Illinois, the way we have been doing it just did not work. and there was a need to make a complete change and do it completely different. So the evidence-based model is a step in the direction of doing funding a lot differently, or at least the way we distribute money a lot differently. But it needed to have support. It needed to have the additional support. So we're proud that in the budget that we passed, that unfortunately none of the Republicans supported, we did put an additional $350 million in for schools, because we needed to guarantee that if we're going to introduce a new model, that model had to have substantial financial support in order to work. So, yes, there were a lot of things that we did that weren't necessarily a part of the governor's discussion, but that was just a discussion. And it talked about, it took us down the pathway toward implementing an evidence-based model. So we have an evidence-based model, and there were additional things added to it. So we walked through it. Of course, unfortunately, we got absolutely no Republican support for the evidence-based model. We passed it out of both chambers. The governor's vetoed it, and mandatorily vetoed it. But unless somebody tells me something different, every district in the state of Illinois gets hurt by the amendatory changes. And that should not be our job. Our job should not be trying to hurt other districts, or for that matter, to pit districts against one another. That shouldn't be our job. We should be moving down a path where we're supporting all districts. We're supporting all kids in the state of Illinois, because I think what we do desire is for every child to have a quality education here in the state of Illinois. That is our job as legislators, and I think that's what all of you as our constituents would want to see happen. And SB1 moves us in the right direction toward doing that. But I think it's clear that the amendatory veto the governor issued simply does not do that. Again, he's taking dollars away and saying to districts, you gain more, but at the expense of another district. Most if not all of the education professionals that I've talked to have no interest in hurting another district so that they gain. And that's the situation that we're in right now. We are making an appeal to our Republican colleagues. Why would you want to support something that hurts children, that hurts districts? And that's exactly what this amendatory veto does. I don't think anybody can argue with that. Bring me a superintendent, have them sit up here, and they will tell you how the amendatory veto hurts them and the manner in which it does hurt them. It makes them account for money that they don't have. TIF money is money that they don't have. They can't see it. So why are we suggesting that they have to account for that money when they can't actually spend it? It's not dollars that they can put into their conversation. Okay, I'm sorry, Amanda.
Oh, it's okay.
Got a little carried away, too. But nevertheless, we felt that it was the right way to go, the right direction to go. And we still feel that is indeed the right way to go. And as these negotiations continue with things that are part of SB1, and for that matter, things that weren't a part of SB1, I know ultimately we will get there.
And now for his 5 minutes to explain the take. Because I know, just drum down your past, 5 years into 5 minutes, please.
I can do that.
Senator Andy Menar.
I can do that. So I'm going to be less than 5 minutes. First of all, thank you to the City Club. This is my third conversation about school funding before this organization. I hope it's my last on this topic. I hope we get it done. I think we can get it done. I want to compliment the three gentlemen that are sitting up here on this panel. I take them at their word when they sit at a negotiating table, that they appear in good faith and that they want to solve the problem. I think they've shown that time and again over the course of any number of years since we began this recent effort to reform school funding in the state. I'm only going to concentrate on the past for one date, and that date is May 31st. And something happened on May 31st that hadn't happened in 20 years, and that is this. A school funding reform bill withstood the test of the legislature, and it was passed by both the House and the Senate, first time in 20 years. So I want to begin by complimenting every legislator in this room who took the brave vote to pass Senate Bill 1. I thank you for doing that. That's all I'm going to say about the past. We can go back and forth on the issues of Senate Bill 1, I guess, during questions. I want to focus my remaining minute or so on urgency. My kids start school tomorrow. They're going to walk through the doors of a school building that I went to that's 58% funded at what it should be today by any calculation. That's immoral. It's cruel. It's happening everywhere in the state, not just to white children in small towns downstate, but to children all over the state here in the city of Chicago and in suburban communities. That's a fact. And as we sit here and eat lunch, that rotten system is rotting as we sit here today. This calls for decisive action, not just for the school year that's beginning today and tomorrow throughout the state, and then later for other districts. It calls for decisive action because we've been at this now for a very long time. I had a call yesterday from Senator Berman, who knows the right moments to call me. And he said this to me, and I said this during the Senate debate on the override vote. I think it's imperative that we recognize that this moment can't go by us this time. It cannot go by us this time. And that's what Senator Berman's remarks were to me yesterday on the phone. He said, don't let this moment go by this time. You guys can fix it. Don't let the moment go by. So I'm going to end by making an appeal to everybody in this room. We have a immediate urgency to fix the problem because of school and school year starting now. But we have a historic urgency that is a stain on our state by any metric that is within reach to solve once and for all. And it's our job to get it done.
And last, but of course not least, we have Representative Rob Pritchard.
Thank you, Amanda, and good afternoon to all of you. And I want to thank all of you, and especially some of you that have been working on this issue for the past decade or longer, to bring it to really to the focus that we have today and to try to change how we're funding education in Illinois. Andy talked a little bit about history. I'll go back to 1970 when we passed a constitution that said the state should pay a majority share of the education costs. We did, I think, for the first year or two after that, Senator Brady. But after that, we lagged well behind. And after college, when I came back to Illinois for our family business, I joined an effort called Changing How Illinois Education is Funded, CHIEF. That was back in the early 70s, right after we passed the Constitution. And we've been working for that length of time to really get the state to pony up to the costs that it has for the most important service it provides, and that's for the future of every young individual in our state. So it's been a long fight, and it's taken the efforts of many of you to bring us where we are today. And I think as our Governor's Commission met last year, there was very quick consensus that, A, we needed to change the funding formula, but, B, that the evidence-based model was a model that deserved to be implemented in Illinois and provide our school districts with what I call a toolbox of resources to provide for the needs of every student in their district. And that's one of the things that I think the evidence-based model brings for us is the fact that we can determine the cost of education, the adequacy target for every school district. And taxpayers that say they're paying too much can look at that adequacy target and see if, in fact, they are contributing too much on the local level. But there's no doubt that we are asking our property taxpayers to pay too much. And that's why I say to those individuals that say the evidence-based model may be putting too much money into education, is until we get to adequacy, it's not enough. And until we get to a majority funding, it's not enough. And that's where this model moves us forward with a toolbox of 27 elements that not every district is currently using. But I think every district should look at and consider, because research-based evidence says those are the best practices that lead to student growth, that help the many needs that our students have today that students didn't have 5 or 10 years ago. Students today require a lot of support and services. Maybe that's not the role of education, but that's the time and place that we have to address some of those needs if we're going to change the outlook for a lot of our citizens and a lot of our communities across the state. So the evidence-based model is a model that we do support. Contrary to what you heard a moment ago, Republicans do support the evidence-based model. Not all. Some of them think the current formula is adequate. But there's a diversity of opinion across our state. But I would come back and say that the model that was introduced back in April, Will Davis had Senate Bill or House Bill 2808, was a bill that I co-sponsored with him, was a bill that capsuled the evidence-based model into legislation and did a lot of the practices and dealt with regionalization and tried to deal with the needs of special students, the needs of Chicago in special ways. I had problems then, and I had problems when we voted on it in the House, the fact that at the last hour we brought in some of the pension issues that have already been alluded to that need to be addressed through the pension code, not distorting our evidence-based model with those kinds of costs. I think if we can continue the discussion and come up with a new bill, we can reach consensus on these issues that support the needs of Chicago and the students in Chicago, that can deal with an adequate and equitable way of funding students across the state, and keep the focus on student growth, not necessarily district hold harmless. That was a key message in our governor's commission, is we wanted to focus on the student needs. And when you focus on district needs that are losing students, you're diverting resources that ought to be used through the formula to go to those students that need it around the state, not just to one or two or 10 or a dozen school districts. That's where holding harmless per student, dealing with the issues of the block grant, are of critical importance to us Republicans as we try to negotiate a solution here. And the block grant was mentioned earlier. It was a formula that was created back in 1995 when the Chicago Public Schools had crisis at that time, and the legislature gave the mayor and the city control over the school district, and they gave them block grants so they didn't have to apply per student for various programs like every other school district in the state has to. That's what we call the block grant. And that was to cut down costs, perhaps, but to be an adequate representation of the student population in 1995. In 2017, we're at an entirely different student population for Chicago. And that's where we have $202 million that's in excess of what a per-student program would justify in the city. And that's why we've been focused on that issue. If we're going to put that as a base funding minimum and the hold harmless, then it should be adequate and accurate for the student population that Chicago has today, and that we use that money adequately around the state. So those are a couple of the differences that we have in how the model has been shaped in Senate Bill 1. But I think there are differences that can be resolved, and we can very quickly get another bill that brings forth the evidence-based model and deals with some of these issues that we have on a political basis with the bill that we have today.
And that is where we will have to leave it. Representative Pritchard, thank you so much. I did want to begin by just asking that question. As you move forward and look at the possibility of a compromise, I actually last evening had the opportunity to ask Governor Bruce Rauner, what do you need to be part of an education funding formula bill in order to sign on to it? And he said that there is nothing, no part of his mandatory veto that has to be included. So I have a twofold question there. First of all, do you believe the governor, or is he just not showing his cards there? And second of all, how about each of you? Could you go down the line and briefly express what has to be part of a measure in order for it to get your vote and, frankly, for you to believe it will pass by your colleagues? And go ahead, whoever wants to be, we can just go right down the order. I'll leave it back to Berrickman, please.
Sure. Thanks, Amanda. I outlined in my opening some of the key issues. I think the key issues, you know, it's hard to imagine how exactly everything gets resolved because none of us are going to get everything that we want. I think some of the key issues need to be resolved. Those include how we handle Chicago's pensions, whether or not Chicago, whether or not your view is that the state should pay those Chicago pensions, my belief strongly is that those pensions not be embedded to the school funding formula and that they ought to be placed in the pension code the way we deal with the state teacher retirement system pensions. The discussion at the commission about whether to have a conversation about pensions with school funding concluded with, I believe, strong beliefs by members of both parties that pension issues should be dealt with in the pension code and not in the school code. Because imagine what happens over time. As legislators and budgeteers are making budget decisions about what to fund for school funding, K through 12, we'll all have to know in the back of our head that some of that money really is going towards pensions. Now, around the state, some people think that we ought to call pensions and school funding, it's all one pile of money. But the reality is, in Springfield, they're different. They're separate appropriations, and we, the legislature, makes decisions about how much money they want to spend on K through 12 schools, it's viewed as classrooms, versus how much we spend on pensions. So if the state is going to pick up Chicago's pensions, I believe it should not be in the formula as it is in Senate Bill 1. It should be outside the formula. I think Democrats have agree with that. They privately say that that is good policy. The stakeholders who have chimed in along this debate have all said it's better dealt with in the pension code. Why it's in Senate Bill 1, I presume, is a political decision. That's how we get votes. We make sometimes illogical decisions in order to get votes.
Senator Berkman, would you agree if there was a separate pension bill that funded Chicago pensions, will you say here in front of this audience that you would vote for it, for CPS pensions?
So the change then becomes, the change then becomes, if we're going to place an obligation on Illinois taxpayers to make this additional cost, to incur this additional cost, how do we sell it to taxpayers? Now, I believe that a mechanism that can be used to sell it to taxpayers and to school districts is to give school districts the flexibility that CPS has to manage its personnel costs. Again, this is one of the benefits that exists under the law today, is that Chicago has the right to control some of its personnel costs in a manner that no other district does. So could there be a trade that could be sold to taxpayers? You're going to pay more for Chicago's pensions, but you're going to get more flexibility in your local school districts, which means you're going to drive down the local district costs and hopefully drive down property taxes. I think that's a discussion that negotiators have had. It's a discussion that we've all, legislators, have had, and I think that is a path to a solution on this.
All right. So, Representative Davis, could you go ahead and give your musts, but if you also wanted to briefly explain why you believe it was that the pension provisions were inserted into the mix of the formula for Senate Bill 1 versus being dealt with separately?
Well, certainly in the same manner in which we tried to support all other districts, Chicago has some specific asks as well. And so we tried to accommodate those asks by way of Senate Bill 1, but certainly we didn't accommodate any of their asks at the expense of other districts. So we account for a pension payment for the city of Chicago in the same manner that we – well, not the same manner, but in the manner in which the state is picking up pension costs for all others. So let me remind those of you who live in the city of Chicago, you pay for two pensions. You pay for the downstate teachers, and then you also pay for Chicago. Whereas for those of us who don't live in the city of Chicago, we pay only one. And that's for downstate teachers. And that's the cost that we have been picking up for years. So this was an opportunity to create some parity, if you will, relative to how we deal with situations in the city of Chicago. So in terms of must-haves, I mean, I'm open to everything that we're talking about. But again, I'm not interested in hurting districts. And so far, some of the things that have been brought to the table may have a disparate impact on districts. And I can't understand why any of us would want to consider anything that has an impact, a negative impact, on districts. So to the extent in which some of the other items that have been brought into the conversation that weren't a part of SB 1 from the very beginning, I mean, we're entertaining those conversations. We're entertaining those items. I think there was several other items the senator could have put out there to say that are must-haves in order to try to move forward on that. Yes, we are looking at a different way to deal with Chicago pensions. I mean, I think the concern was that is that sometimes when you kind of hitch the cars of the train together, it all moves together. But when you start putting cars on other tracks, it has the ability not to move. And I think that's kind of the challenge with any part of this bill is that when we start separating the pieces, the question is, does those other pieces move? If we're all moving to, if it's all together, we can all move together and we can still get the bill passed that funds adequately our schools, implements an evidence-based model, provides for Chicago's pension costs as well, and probably a host of other things. But again, it moves districts forward, and that's exactly what we are attempting to do or want to do with the passage of SB1.
Senator Menard and Representative Pritchard, are there any must-haves for you that you would like to quickly list off?
So here's my must-haves. We need a system that's adequately funded and that's equitably funded. I don't care how we get there. That's what we need. I'm the only panelist here, by the way, who was not an original proponent of the evidence-based model, which I think is evidence that there's no pride of authorship, that if there's a proposal that produces a system that's adequately funded over time and equitably funded over time, that's something we should all support, because that's the goal, adequacy and equity in public education, which in both metrics we score at or near the bottom on any scale when comparing us to other states. So that's my must-haves, adequacy and equity. Other things that come to the table, if they don't deal with adequacy and equity, they should be dealt with separately. But Senate Bill 1 is a good proposal. It should be the law. It should be the law in the state of Illinois. It's battle-tested. It's supported by educators across the state. It's good public policy. The idea that we're going to deal with inequity in pension funding in Illinois somewhere else without having a discussion about school funding is just plain silly in my mind. There's all kinds of inequity in today's system. There's terrible inequity in today's system. There's special deals for different types of school districts all over the place. The difference between those and CPS pensions is they don't grab the headlines and they're not as visceral to voters in downstate Illinois. That's the only difference. Nobody's running around downstate saying, my gosh, we got to go after that PTEL adjustment, right? No one would care, would they? Here's the facts. The bill gives $221 million to CPS for its normal costs. We make an adjustments for its unfunded liability, which is the debt that CPS still has to pay. TRS gets a $4 billion payment with no debate, which is a $600 million increase over last fiscal year. That's what the bill does. That's not a bailout. That's parity. Along with that, we get a system that drives us toward adequacy and equity.
And Representative Pritchard, briefly, please.
Yeah.
So that has been the battle cry since we started, adequacy and equity. But the issues are when we get down in the weeds, so to speak, about how we achieve adequacy and equity. And for me, as we look at what the governor did and the points that I think that was your question, the points that we thought he was maybe hitting in the right direction, comes back to the discussion about per student focus and how we use the model. The question about looking at the block grant and bringing some fairness there to a reimbursement that's not based by the number of students and the needs that the money was intended. I think the discussion the governor also raised about TIF districts, we mentioned PTEL, but TIF districts are another one, and those are being gamed around the state so they can hide the amount of money that a school district is putting into education. We've got to look at TIF districts going forward to make sure that if the district is getting money from the TIF district, that that money is counted towards their local capacity target. That's something that the governor brought up again. I think you've got to look at how we give property tax relief and having a voter referendum for those districts that are over 110% of adequacy, for example, giving voters a chance to say, let's lower our property taxes. The bill also has in it a tax swap. And that's another issue that hasn't been discussed very much at all. But that idea, again, could allow some property tax relief without taking local money away, but giving state funds to that area and bringing us more towards that adequacy that the Constitution requires.
Now, the governor's mandatory veto, Senator Berkman, you said you didn't even know what was in it, and yet you have been really the leader for Republicans on this initiative for education funding reform. How is it that it was so very different from what we had been hearing from the governor in terms of a bailout? And what do you think of it? Is it possible to tackle, for example, something as complicated as TIFs before schools open their doors?
So,
or maybe a weekend. The easy, fun part of school where they're not taking tests yet.
I think, look, you know, maybe you should have the governor here to answer that question. But what I can say to the mandatory veto, and this builds on, you know, what Representative Pritchard just outlined. There are some important provisions within that mandatory veto that have been debated. They're discussed in the negotiations. And there are strong policy reasons for which we need to have a more thorough public discussion, and hopefully both sides will give consideration. Consider this. The mandatory veto removes some of the cost drivers. We haven't talked about that a lot, but the mandatory veto removes some of the cost drivers that are part and parcel to Senate Bill 1. The cost drivers that year after year will drive up the costs of implementing an evidence-based model in the state of Illinois. Those cost drivers, they're called escalators and regionalization factors, those cost drivers have an incredible role on tying the hands of future legislators from setting priorities in the budgeting process. In fact, what they do is tie their hands and limit legislators' ability to budget by saying that the law automatically makes increases year after year to the amount of money that goes into school funding. Now, this is where this is interesting, because if we were to look at the last 10 years of school funding in our state, what you see is that legislators, the General Assembly, and the governor, whomever it is at the time, makes budgeting decisions. They set priorities. Over the last 10 years, some years, the legislature and the governor made decisions to cut school funding or to hold school funding flat. They did that presumably as a result of making other budget priorities. More recently, we've made decisions to increase the funding in school funding. So by removing these cost drivers from the formula, I think we're empowering legislators to do what they're supposed to do, which is represent people, the 13 million of the state, and make budgetary decisions on their behalf. Why tie next year's General Assembly? Why tie their hands? Why not allow them to do their job, given whatever priorities exist in the state at next year's time?
And I will would love for one of the Democrats, perhaps on the panel, to respond to that briefly, including a question from somebody here in the lovely audience who says, opinions do not educate our students. Quality education does. How do we ensure every student gets a quality education? What does adequacy mean to you, and should education be the number one priority? So a lot there, but I think really distill it down to that. Should education be the number one priority, and is that what Senate Bill 1 in its original form says in terms of budget measures or guarantees, the escalator issue that Senator Berrickman was speaking
to? The answer to your question is yes.
The end.
That's the answer. Let me very, very briefly, and I will ask the senator to chime in on this. This senator talked about cost drivers, like regionalization. Well, one of the great things about regionalization is that it makes a downstate district, which is generally not the wealthiest district, gives them the opportunity to be competitive with teachers. There's a report that I've heard about today from regional offices of education, how they are down 2,000 teachers, and they're losing teachers to the wealthier part of the state because they pay more. So when we talk about regionalization, that's there to try to make downstate districts more competitive so they can attract better teachers. You know, people are going to go where the money is. I think that's the nature of business. So why not have something in place that allows for teachers to make better decisions about where they go instead of always flocking to simply where the dollars appear to be? It gives them the opportunity to do that. So that's why something like that is in the bill, and why we think that having that is a good thing. The hold harmless, and I got to say something about the hold harmless. So hold harmless means you don't hurt anybody. So to have a per pupil expenditure from the onset of this means that those districts that have experienced losses in their population are going to get hurt immediately out the door by having that from the onset. So what we decided to do is to capture where every district is with the hold harmless and leave that district flat right where they are. And then the new dollars will be reflective of those different population shifts that our districts are experiencing. We hear about it all the time. We know that that's a reality. So it's important to characterize the hold harmless in the right way and not say that per pupil is the right way to go, particularly when from the onset it could have a disparate impact on a district. We want to have a hold harmless. That's the way we've operated in this vein ever since that I've been chair of the Appropriations Committee. We always start out by keeping districts flat, and then we make adjustments in different ways from there. So that's extremely important as to point that out as this conversation moves forward.
You know, I would like to have a question. Oh, go ahead. Representative Pritchard, a lot of attention has gone to the Republicans that split from the governor in voting for a budget as well as for an income tax hike. You are one of those individuals. Also, a lot of attention to representatives who may be freer to the thought would be vote one's conscience because they're not running for reelection due to retiring, such as yourself. So can you say here, does that open you up at all to perhaps joining Democrats and voting for an override of Senate Bill 1 if it comes to that?
So I've based my career on looking at the facts, judging policies based on how it affects citizens in my district and across the state. That's why I ended up voting for the budget. That's why I will continue to evaluate every piece of legislation, including SB 1. My decision is that we've skewed SB 1 from what will help every student and that we need to come back with a follow-up bill that will right those deviations and deliver on what we have been working for a decade or more. So I think it's going to be difficult to pass any kind of SB 1 version without coming back and addressing some of the other issues we've already talked about. And when we talk about funding per student or per district, today we are funding per student. Districts are already used to adjustments from year to year. So moving forward doesn't change their expectations. And what it's doing is you're paying a district for students it doesn't help and doesn't have. And we ought to use that money elsewhere where it will do some good.
So I'll take
and
that
I think
as a no for an override.
If you're looking at the cost of living, as we were mentioning a moment ago in regionalization, is the cost of living is less downstate. That's why there's a regionalization factor that reduces some of their adequacy target.
So, Representative Pritchard, I'll take that as a no for voting for an override.
I've said that several times.
Just making sure. Getting it out there clearly. All right. Something that I have not heard discussion of in talking about what needs to be part of this is an issue that has gained attention, and that is the notion of a private school scholarship program supported by tax credits. Do you believe that that will be part of a compromise? And how can the state afford something to the tune of $100 million at a time where we clearly have seen a budget upheaval for the past couple of years, as well as talking about not having enough money perhaps to give schools escalators in years going forward? Who would like to take that up? I don't know who's selling it, but... Is there anybody here that, for whom that is a top priority, and how much is that a part of your negotiations?
Sure. Let me take this. here's what's interesting. We've heard that the Speaker has made a commitment that a scholarship tax credit program will be part of a negotiated agreement for school funding reform. I believe that commitment's been made. He has not made that commitment to me, but I have heard that that commitment has been made. Now, there are varying views on this. To outline the program, the program is designed as a matter of allowing school children choices in the education that they receive. Children have varying needs. Some children attend schools where the school district is not providing the services that a child needs. Some children have very special needs that are met by other school choices that may exist that aren't available to those children in need. And so the idea is that a program could be set up, funded by private contributions, donors, that those donations could then be used to pay for the tuition of school children and give school children more choices. Now, this
type briefly
of,
here, sorry, we're
yeah,
closely
yeah.
running out of
That's
time.
Fine.
Sorry.
I'll conclude. There you go.
Just, do we think that that will be part of a compromise? Can I get a show of hands from the four of you? Is that necessary from your conversations? So no. All
not,
right.
It's not necessary, no. But it was brought by the Republicans to the table as part of the, to cut the deal.
And with that, we have to about finish up. I wanted to throw in, if anybody can get this in their closing remarks, Lawrence Mizzal has a question in terms of why the legislature in the first place created a separate pension for Chicago teachers, so why not absorb that into the downstate pension system? If anybody would choose to take that up, I will give you 30 seconds each. Keep into it, fellas. So let's start with Representative Pritchard and go on down the line.
So we have two pension systems in Illinois because that was the agreement back in 1995. Chicago chose to keep a separate pension system. Yeah. If conditions change and it's time for the state to help share in that pension cost, fine. Then let's also open up all the other agreements that were made in 1995 and bring them to the table and allow all school districts to have the same benefits that CPS has dealing with personnel issues.
And actually, so yes, go ahead, Senator Menard.
I would say that I think it's important to note here in this conversation that much of what Governor Rauner has done over the last month, especially in downstate, is going to prevent thoughtful conversations like that one, Mr. Mizzal, from moving forward. I think the governor has been incredibly divisive. I think he has used that as a political tactic to stall progress on school funding reform as part of a political calculus. One of the outcomes of that are going to be, I think, lasting for many years to come, divisions when it comes to pension issues between Chicago and downstate. I think it is what it is, unfortunately, but I think that's one of the outcomes of what's happened in the past month, especially when we try to write some of these things all over the school code, all over the pension code, especially the one dealing with pensions.
And Representative Will Davis, as you close, I would like to get in a quick lasting question for you. Why not, you realize you're not from the city of Chicago, none of you are, but why not allow the same personnel leeway that CPS gets for every other district? Is that Democrats protecting unions as it has been seen by Republicans?
No, not at all. As part of this process, we are talking about mandate relief, and we have thrown on the table a streamlined process to allow districts, if that's something that they want to try to address, the opportunity to try to address it. But where we're getting into the idea of specifics, got to have this specific one, instead of, if you want that parity across the state, allow districts the opportunity to make their own decisions about which mandates they like to try to address and try to move or get rid of or whatever the case may be. So that's, I think, how we would prefer to try to address it as versus identifying specific mandates in the piece of legislation, which it seems to be the path that we're being driven now versus allowing for a different process that allows districts to interact differently based on what they feel their individual needs are.
And obviously, we will see the Illinois House gather on this issue tomorrow. For very quick closing remarks, Senator Berkman, I will leave you with that. And Aunt, could you please let us know when you and the other educators up here will next meet again, if in fact there are further talks going forward?
I understand there's discussions being had, and I think it's good to see Leader Brady and President Cullerton here today. Hopefully, that's fruitful. We can't fix this fast enough. Is the bottom line. And as Republicans, we stand ready and willing to help do that. The result needs to be a fair formula that's fair for every 852 school districts. It needs to be a formula that works for all school districts. It needs to be one that addresses the inequities of the system that exists today. And we can't get to a solution fast enough. I know that I have tremendous respect for the gentleman up at the table. I look forward to continued conversations with them to try to get this to an agreement as soon as possible.
And with that, could I get a round of applause for our panelists, please?